You know, from that standpoint, I mean, I firmly believe rising tide benefits all boats, in the sense that if you get a million more kids that are staying involved with the sport or just coming to soccer because of the open play dynamic, a good number of them are going to actually go, you know what, I actually think I'm good and I want to go join the club team.
That was Skip Gilbert. And this is Founding Football. It's strange. Despite quitting soccer at 12 or 13 years old, I have many vivid memories of playing the game. In fact, I actually have to dig deeper to extract similar images of my baseball career, which definitely consumed more time and lasted much, much longer. Maybe it's the fall setting and the distinct sensory experience of soccer that etched those memories into my brain. It was crisp, cool air, dewy grass, soaking the socks beneath my cleats, and wrinkling my toes. Maybe it's the acute sharpness of those experiences versus the dulling effect that heat and humidity had during the summer baseball months. It blurs all of those memories. Either way, I remember playing soccer as a kid. The earliest memories I have are of other kids doing amazing things. Brad was a friend of mine. He lived about 10 minutes away, and I slept over at his house in first or second grade. I spent hours eating snacks and talking to his older sister at the kitchen counter. She was a student at Clemson when we were 8 years old, and I was homesick. See, Brad was in my class at school, but I don't remember anything about that. I do, however, remember his sorcery on a soccer field. In my mind, he played like I now know Messi plays. He was short, of course. Who knows what that meant at 8 years old? He might be 6'5 now. But the ball stuck to his foot. He was fast, creative, and seemingly scored all the time. Then there's the bicycle kick. While there's no doubt in my mind the previous descriptions have probably been embellished by memory over time, I can remember that bicycle kick as if it happened yesterday. Brad executed at 8 years old a perfect bicycle kick that you would see in the Premier League today. It was absolutely amazing. He scored from what was probably only 5 yards away, but it looked like 20 at the time. Ball in the air, powerful leap, cartwheel overhead, pure strike. I have my memories of my own play as well. I wasn't fast or skillful, so I was never seen as an attacker, or like a center back or an outside back, sometimes a midfielder. And I also played goalkeeper. One of my proudest moments came from the keeper spot. I have hazy memories of making various saves on one of my teams, and the coach, the Scottish father of my friend Dave, coached me up with his accented enthusiasm. There was an instruction on how to move within the box, positioning, and most importantly, how to be an 11th outfield player. This was heady stuff for what I'm guessing was maybe my 10-year-old soccer year, but it produced amazing moments. On a sunny day when we had a late game, which meant it started probably at 11 instead of 8 a.m., I got the nod in net. There was an early breakaway in the game, and it was just me, the keeper, against the other team's striker in a 1v1 situation. I remember him bearing down on me, and that's when I heard Mr. Harris screaming, "Go get it! Come out! Challenge him!" What? I'm allowed to do that? I thought my job was to stay in goal. But I listened, began charging, and made a sliding tackle that saved what was otherwise probably a sure goal. Ironically, it was the last year of youth soccer that was both my best and the one that discouraged me from continuing. I was moved into a midfield role and found my footing both defensively and as an attacking weapon. Don't get me wrong, I still wasn't a goal scorer, but I had a knack for passing. And before Instagram and acrobatics made it in vogue to use throw-ins as glamorous set pieces, I was really, really good at them. I could easily throw the ball further than anyone else in our league. I was so good at it, in fact, that I assisted, no exaggeration, over 30 goals that year on throw-ins alone. See, we had an incredible center forward, his name was Brian, on our team, and he recognized my talent and we formed this connection. He would find space sprinting towards net farther than anyone believed I could throw the ball. So he'd run unmarked and I'd deliver it to him essentially in a breakaway situation. And more often than not, he'd score. I had a great season. It was recognized by my teammates and parents, but not the other coaches. And they are the ones that vote for the All-Star team, which then becomes a travel team. And I wasn't invited. See, the fast kids were, the goal scorers were, but I was not. It was the first time I became aware of soccer pathways, travel teams, tournaments. A few years later, I would learn about the existence of the Olympic Development Program, or ODP, another pathway that I felt confident I wouldn't have been good enough to follow. But Brian did, and other kids around me did as well. They were the ones that tried out for middle school soccer, so I stayed away. Those pathways were the evolution of fall morning intramural games, and they were the evolution given to kids by U.S. Youth Soccer. When it was founded in 1974, USYS wasn't the first youth soccer organization in the United States, but it quickly became the biggest. It also codified those pathways from those intramural fields to those travel tournaments to regional and ultimately national recognition as part of a team or of the Olympic Development Program, elevating the profile of youth soccer through its unique national infrastructure is the reason we've chosen the founding of U.S. Youth Soccer in 1974 as Chapter 4 of Founding Football. Focusing on youth soccer for this project was an obvious decision. This will be the first chapter related to this topic, but not the last. Long before we could argue that soccer fandom reached an inflection point in the United States, kids were playing soccer, lots and lots of kids, all over the country, as many as 3 million by the year 2000, up from 810,000 in 1980. What you do with your time does not define a culture. Just walk into any workplace and sit in a cubicle, and this concept will come to life, or maybe do nothing at all, which is the point. But you can't start to create a common culture without common experiences. So even if you want to argue that youth soccer participation didn't, in its own right, build a culture of soccer fandom in America, it was certainly a building block. As we discussed in the Title IX episode, there were also reasons for youth soccer to expand. College programs for both men and women by the 1970s, they needed development pools. U.S. Youth Soccer started doing that with its founding in 1974 and has helped to do that ever since. It gave commonality to the game in different states, built national structures that brought kids together, and elevated the idea of youth soccer within the country in a way that had not previously been done. U.S. Youth Soccer, as we'll talk about, also forged those pathways that I mentioned before in a clearer way than this country had ever seen. The approach to youth soccer, it let you start playing intramurals and stay at the same club your entire childhood, if you wanted to, but still have the opportunities to make the national team. That was true whether you were a child playing soccer in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, or Ohio. The same structures existed and gave the youth ranks the commonality to help create a culture from activity. Instead of just participating, you could grow, develop, and evolve in the youth game. Thanks to U.S. Youth Soccer and the approach it took from its founding in 1974 through today. For the astute listener, you've likely noticed that we are moving chronologically through our chosen moments in this Founding Football project. Important moments build. That's one of the reasons we've taken a timeline approach to the show, and also a great way to consider the relevance of U.S. Youth Soccer's founding. In 1972, Title IX was passed, opening the door to college for girls through soccer. In 1975, Pelé would come to North America and create a commercial thirst for the game with an international flavor. And in 1977, Anson Dorrance made the UNC women's soccer program a beacon of competitive light in the previously dark U.S. soccer landscape. Nestled right in between then was the founding of U.S. Youth Soccer, which changed the infrastructure around the youth game and, over time, would make it clear to kids with dreams how many of those roads could be followed. The U.S. Youth Soccer Association was not the first organizing body for the youth game in America. That designation goes to AYSO, or the American Youth Soccer Association, founded in 1964, nearly 10 years before USYS. AYSO is the oldest national youth soccer organization in the country. It was founded in a garage in Torrance, California, and it's still headquartered in Torrance today. The original organization consisted of 9 teams. AYSO was, and still is, built on the principle of encouraging participation. Their motto is, quote, "Everybody plays," which frankly is awesome. That mantra put them in a leadership position relative to other issues that brought together sports and society, such as female participation and support. The organization introduced its first girls team in 1971, the year before Title IX's landmark passage. Any kid who signed up for an AYSO team was guaranteed playing time, and the competitive balance was so important to their philosophy that team rosters were often and are often still shuffled to prevent any one team from becoming too dominant. It's an incredible mindset that honestly we've lost with the growth of a pay-to-play approach for youth soccer in America. We live in a world where now the idea of just playing soccer for the sake of playing is often overlooked. The pathway for development and the achievement is valued at a premium. Clubs know it, and as a business, they take advantage of it. And yet, AYSO was the starting point for some of the most famous names in American soccer, even with that philosophy. Landon Donovan is probably one of the most well-known professional soccer players who began his soccer career at AYSO. The U.S. men's national team legend told Soccer Today that, quote, "The beauty of AYSO is that you have kids from all walks of life who just wanted to be active and run around and play soccer. I started playing soccer at the age of 10, but I wanted to continue playing AYSO because I enjoyed the camaraderie and the ability to just play for the love of playing. The games were still competitive, but they never revolved around winning," end quote. Not about winning. One of the most competitive soccer players of all time embraced the egalitarian mindset of AYSO, and he did just fine. And he's not the only one. Household soccer names like Alex Morgan, Julie Foudy, Eric Winalda, Shannon Box, Amy Rodriguez, Steve Cherundolo, Maurice Adu, and Brad Guzan all came out of the AYSO ranks as well. Another grassroots organization with an even more democratized approach to gameplay would soon follow AYSO. The Soccer Association for Youth, or SAY, was established in 1967 in Cincinnati, Ohio. There were 8 founders, 27 teams, and about 400 players under the organization's umbrella its first year. Much like AYSO, the organization was formed with the objective of making soccer fun for the kids. As we've discussed, the Midwest had a thriving soccer culture emanating primarily from the St. Louis area. 5 hours east, by car, Cincinnati saw a cultural soccer boom in the 70s as well. And sprawling outward from the city towards Dayton on one side and Kentucky on the other, SAY Soccer picked up additional member clubs as it grew. Then in 1972, the same year as Title IX, SAY announced the beginning of the girls' program led by Marianne Kaminsky. SAY continued to influence soccer growth. In 1980, Pele visited Cincinnati Children's Hospital as part of a SAY Soccer promotion. An autographed ball still highlights the SAY Soccer office display. In 2017, SAY Soccer celebrated its 50th anniversary. Today, the organization is a proud member of the U.S. Soccer Federation, USSF, with 100,000 players in 35 states. So with 2 robust youth soccer organizations established in 1964 and 1967, what made U.S. youth soccer a necessary evil? As Hal Phillips points out in his excellent book, Generation Zero, the broader societal shift in the early 1970s is also important to consider as part of the why behind U.S. youth soccer being the right organization at the right time in America. For a variety of reasons, two-income households dramatically increased in the 1970s, creating a new paradigm in the middle class. With so many kids now coming home to empty houses, activities were at a premium, specifically the ability to participate in activities that empowered rather than curtailed this youthful freedom. They were the most valued. Philip posits this was part of the appeal of soccer. It's a game where parents and coaches weren't continually ordering kids around. They weren't calling plays or formation on their kids' behalf. They weren't micromanaging and otherwise intruding in the run of play. Ironic words when you consider the state of U.S. soccer today, but it makes sense as a factor in the growth of the game then. And those factors contributed to the youth soccer revolution. With AYSO and Say Soccer in place, one would think there was no need for another organizing body. And while it's hard to draw any concrete conclusions, it's easy to see how organizations built almost entirely on the idea of volunteer parent coaches wouldn't thrive quite as readily with a dramatic shift to two-income households. There aren't as many parents available to coach, and parents would want their kids coached by more dedicated individuals with more structured organizations. As Phillips pointed out, this was also a time when the sport shifted to the suburbs. Prior to the 70s, soccer had an urban concentration, and in the 70s, it began to shift into the burbs as part of that two-income, middle-class household phenomenon. In many regards, U.S. youth soccer was best suited for that shift. Donald Greer was the founding chairman of the organization in 1974. He, along with two other co-founders, Carl Grosch and Robert Nessler, gave U.S. soccer a brand new look. Together, the group wrote the constitution and regulation that outlined the structure of their vision for youth soccer in America. At the time of USYS's founding, Greer was already the vice president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, and the organization began with a USSF affiliation, tightly coupling the two entities and immediately establishing a relationship that would help create those pathways to make USYS unique as a development platform in the soccer world. And from day one, USYS had scale. There were 100,000 registered players that first year in 1974. The structure democratized the organization of soccer from day one, and in doing so, brought it together. When combining all of these elements, it quickly surpassed other organizations on a scaled level. By 1980, the growth in youth soccer overall was already dramatic for all genders, with over 900,000 youth participating. By 1985, this was over 1.5 million, reaching 2 million in 1990, 2.5 million in 1995, and over 3 million by 2000. Kids were playing soccer in absolutely huge numbers. The secret to USYS is that basically it's a group of groups, and it brings those groups together in new and unique ways to give clubs and teams novel challenges outside their locality, but still within the framework that USYS provides. The top-level structures happen at the state level. USYS oversees 55 member state associations, encompassing 10,000 clubs and leagues, along with close to 1 million administrators, coaches, and volunteers. The membership body features one state association per state, except for California, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Each of them have two. And each of the state associations funnels up to one of four regional associations, East, Midwest, South, and West. This lets top teams from the state associations play each other in regional competitions, and the top regional winners play at the national level. There are three levels of competition that foster this interstate and interregional competitive atmosphere: the National Championship Series, the USYS National League, and the President's Cup. All through different structures, deliver state, regional, and national competition at differing levels. And these premises existed from day one. Simple enough. Structures, competition, organization. So while the primary characteristics of AYSO and Say Soccer were equal playing time and fun, USYS appealed to the competitive appetite of America at just the time when a number of things converged. College soccer was becoming a more realistic option for boys and girls alike. Parents were working more, and achievement was an increasing value of the American middle class. And soccer was becoming visible at a professional level again with the foundation of the North American Soccer League, or NASL, which had been founded in 1967 and began playing in 1968. Don't worry, we'll be talking about that as well. It's no wonder that emulating achievement through soccer at the youth level worked. This is where it's worth remembering Greer, and also then the USYS affiliation with US Soccer. That means that a club in Fairfield, Connecticut, developing 9-year-old players, is affiliated with a top governing body in the US, and then ultimately, the world, FIFA. The FIFA affiliation seemed superficial to some degree, even with the idea of growing regional and national championships. That is until 1977, when ODP was formed. The U.S. Youth Soccer Olympic Development Program, ODP, was formed in 1977 to identify a pool of players in each age group from which a national team would be selected for international competition. Tryouts are held, and then players are selected to play for those state affiliations. They're provided with high-level training. And it was designed that way to grow all participating players at all levels through the use of licensed coaches. And they developed a mechanism to exchange ideas and a curriculum to improve all levels of coaching and therefore all levels of players. ODP quickly and sustainably became a pipeline for the top U.S. soccer talent in the country to be identified, cultivated, and elevated to a national team level. It became a means to recruit for colleges. It had gravity, and it changed the face of soccer in America. Here's how that elevation works. Once you made a state association ODP team, through tryouts as described above, you train with other selected kids and are rostered for tournaments against other state ODP teams at regional tournaments. Coaches get to know you and have an opinion about your abilities, which is helpful when you attend a regional camp. Now, those same players against whom you competed in, say, North Carolina, now they're your peers for a week of training with a group of professional licensed coaches. And the premise of camp is more development. But the reality of camp is more identification. Over the course of a week, players are evaluated and then invited to train at the next level, sometimes within the camps themselves on a different field where they're really competing to continue moving on. The process repeats itself until a group is part of a national team pool, ultimately being groomed to play for their country internationally. Look no further than last year's U.S. Women's National Team World Cup roster. There were 23 names in that squad. All 23 were USYS alums. 21 of the players had been part of ODP. The best women's team in the world, even though they didn't get the results they wanted last year, they developed through the USYS system. The evolution of ODP as a layer on top of the democratic structure of U.S. youth soccer truly illustrates how the organization became the most relevant U.S. youth soccer pipeline in the country. It simultaneously brought teams and clubs from all over the country together and found a way to separate the cream of the crop at the very same time. And it worked. Much like AYSO can boast successful alums, every major national team roster over the last few decades is littered with USYS and ODP participants. Now, arguably, ODP may also be responsible for the emergence of additional elite youth soccer leagues and the spiraling of pay-to-play challenges that now face the U.S. youth soccer landscape, because enterprising business people saw that parents would pay for that elite coaching and the opportunities to play more. But we will get to that in a future episode. If you look around that fractured youth soccer landscape now, there are choices and more choices and more choices, and they are all expensive. The middle-class trend that started in the 70s has basically now run wild. Talk to a seemingly educated soccer parent, and they can tell you the path to youth soccer glory and college scholarship assurances, and often those recommendations include the elite club's National League, better known as the ECNL, and academy programs, the Development Academy on the boys' side and the Girls' Academy on the girls' side. And we'll dig into these programs more in future episodes. But one thing worth saying now is this. There's an undercurrent in recent years that USYS programs and ODP have lost some of their value. In large part, this narrative is driven by the competing leagues trying to capture attention and spend of the players staying solely at their club. But success stories tell us something different. They tell us that USYS programs are not only developing top players, but doing it in increasingly historic ways. Last year, Chloe Ricketts signed a 3-year contract with the Washington Spirit of the National Women's Soccer League, the NWSL, arguably the best professional women's league in the world. Ricketts is a USYS success story. She competed for multiple years in the USYS National League with a boys team from Michigan. And then Ricketts joined the Spirit, a squad that already featured 9 total National League alums on its preseason roster, including fellow former USYS national champion Sam Staub. Here's the crazy thing. She was 15 when she signed her professional contract, making the Michigan native the youngest contracted player in NWSL history. With her signing, Ricketts surpassed Portland Thorn FC's Olivia Moultrie as the youngest player to sign a contract in NWSL history. As the National League alum was 3 days younger at the time she signed her deal with Washington. U.S. youth soccer mattered almost immediately when it was founded in 1974, and it still matters today. It's provided proven mechanisms for youth soccer players to get on a field for fun and find a competitive development path to pursue as well. Here to talk about the evolution of the organization and soccer around it, I'm fortunate to have 2 well-known individuals in the soccer community. Today's guests on Founding Football are Skip Gilbert, CEO of U.S. Youth Soccer, and Tom Meredith, a man that's held numerous leadership positions in prominent soccer organizations, such as Women's United Soccer Association and U.S. Soccer Federation, and worked on too many events to count, including multiple men's and women's FIFA World Cups. I want to thank you both for being here.
Our pleasure.
Absolutely, Ken. Glad to be here.
Skip, I'm going to start by asking you about your relationship with Tom. When I reached out to invite you onto the podcast, I said I wanted to discuss the importance of U.S. youth soccer through kind of the moment of its founding in 1974. You said, let me bring on someone that knows history. So how do you and Tom know each other? How have you worked together in the past? I want to hear the story.
Well, from my purview, I joined U.S. soccer back in the late 1990s. I had actually captured by film Hank Steinbrecher walking across the field at the Olympics, and I sent him a picture, his picture, you know, that we didn't have digital then. And I said, if you're ever looking to bring sales and marketing in-house, hire me. And 2 weeks later, I was in Dan Flynn's office. 3 weeks after that, I was hired by U.S. Soccer, and Tom was a part of it, and we became good friends since then.
Tom, have you worked with Skip in his current role as much, or are you just an advisor? How do you think of your impact on his role?
Well, first, we're good friends. And like Skip said, we've known each other a long time, and I respect him greatly. He's got not the easiest job in American soccer at the moment, herding all those cats. But like I said, we've been friends. I knew him from the college standpoint because I was not involved directly, but followed his career at UVM. I knew he was a pretty good goalkeeper, and I've always had an affinity for referees and goalkeepers. So I follow those two guys, those two people in our sport. But we haven't had a direct involvement. I see him at the coaches convention all the time. And we haven't talked in a while, but because I'm sort of pulled back a little bit. But he is definitely one of the people that you need to listen to when you're talking about what's going on in the country at the moment.
So, Tom, you've seen soccer evolve in this country, and I think it's important to not only look from the top down, right? You can give the perspective of working with the top professional leagues, the top international events. How would you describe the importance of youth soccer in the landscape of American sports?
It's where it starts. It's always a neighbor that has a son that's playing. So he's your best friend. So you want to play on his team. It's, It's getting to know the neighborhood. It's getting to know your town. I mean, in New England, in Massachusetts, it's a town related. That's how you organize it. And in that way, you become friends if you're in a club that has the various levels to go up, you're going to play, U8, U10, and then go on. And certainly that kind of a career. And now it's nothing to travel places and to go to tournaments. I think that's probably the biggest thing is the ease of tournaments, either in your region or even in your state. I mean, you want to go to a tournament in Texas, if you're in El Paso and you want to go to Shreveport, that's a 12-hour trip. So unless you fly. So I think it's a no-brainer to say that's the building block. That's where it starts.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that because as a parent who has flown my child 5 hours away just to play teams that we could have driven 30 minutes to play, it's interesting to hear you say how easy regional tournaments should or could be. We'll get back into that, Skip. I want to ask you then, what do you think the role of USU soccer is in that landscape? Then it's still the largest youth sports organization in the country. So what do you see as the role of the organization?
You know, it's a little bit of everything in the sense that we create the pathways. You know, we have 54 state associations that are literally the boots on the grounds to be able to help connect kids with their clubs through their leagues, to be able to give them the competitive flavor that they need for whatever skill level they are. You know, you talk about the U6s outside of chasing butterflies. Some of them are going to be able to say, you know what, this is a sport I really want to excel at. And they need to have that pathway. You know, others are, as the USOPC had recently said, every organization in every sport needs two pathways. One for the kids that are going to play professionally or play for their national team. And one pathway for those that when they turn 40, still want to play in their bar league. And so we need both of them, but you need an organization like ours to be able to connect the dots and make sure that all of those mechanisms, the operational logistics are in place so the kids can just go to the field and play.
The chasing butterflies comment was funny because I have vivid memories of watching my now 17-year-old daughter, who's going to play college soccer next year, start and tell us she hated being on the field. And we said, okay, just stand there and see what happens. And 14 years later, she's still playing. So you're right. Those pathways vary quite a bit. Tom, you probably have a perspective on what the country as a soccer nation was like in 1974 when USU Soccer was founded. Talk about that a bit. Where was soccer at that point? And what was the importance of maybe helping get the youth game organized at a period of time when there was interest, but it was still lagging other sports?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it wasn't that far removed from the professional situation in 67, which started with the two leagues and they merged, and then there's the NASL. But you've always had, even before that time, you had the ASL, and I'm talking about the top tier. I get that as a starting point.
Yep.
And then because of all those teams, and I'm sure Skip has done it in his college days and his club days, And I've been involved with a bunch of those NASL teams, and I'll use Dallas Tornado, one of the oldest ones, as an example. Those guys, Ken Cooper, Mike Renshaw, Turner, Roy Turner, those guys touched, and I mean that in a positive way, those guys touched more kids in Dallas, Texas by doing clinics, and they did it willingly because they loved the sport. They wanted to pass on their passion, and that's how it started. And so those went on, and if a young person loved it when they were 7 or 8 and they had other brothers and sisters, well, then they wanted to be like big brother and sister, and it just sort of perpetuated itself. And it was just a matter of numbers in terms of how many numbers we had, and it was hard enough, and I'm not casting aspersions, but it was hard enough for the Federation to keep track of most of the stuff they were doing, let alone, I mean, they were a three-person outfit, if you can think of that. The first time I visited the U.S. Soccer Federation in room 4010 at the Empire State Building was probably in 1972 or something like that. And they only had three people there. So you had to have those localized organizations. And I think, Skip, correct me, but I think that's where it started, is they realized that you couldn't adjudicate or run the teams in California, or the two sections in California, North and South, from New York. You had to have a little closer, you know, and that's where the regions came from. That's where, you know, those Don Greer and all those very early veterans, because he's the father of U.S. youth soccer in California, and then it went to other places. But it had to start someplace. We had more players than they could handle on a national basis, and they're doing a great job now because it's a little bit easier communication-wise, and they, Skip and those folks have been doing it since 1974. And it's really a matter of just keeping doing the right things and educating the kids, the referees, the coaches. All that stuff has come up through that beginning, and that's why we're doing so well.
Yeah, let's dig into that, because when U.S. soccer was founded in 1974, there were other youth soccer organizations already in existence. American Youth Soccer Organization was prominent enough, still exists. There's been a number of, obviously, young players that have gone through that program. What was the difference? Was it that regionalization when you look at the structure of the organization, Skip, when you look at the way you are continuing to build out community outreach and programs and competitive capabilities? It's really clear that the regionalization is important. You think that's always been a big piece of it, and will it be also going forward?
Sure. And again, you know, if you think about it, with 50 states and having a state association boots on the ground there, you know, back in the 1970s, we didn't have technology. If you were going to sign and get your player cards, you had to fill out a spreadsheet on paper. You had to turn everything in to your registrar. And so there really wasn't a centralized funnel for all of this information to be able to just go sit with U.S. soccer. And I do think that because of that structure and because of the flow of information from the state association to USYS up to U.S. soccer, you know, U.S. soccer kind of depended on U.S. youth as sort of its de facto youth structure, if you will. It was its youth governing body. And then, you know, a few years later, there, you know, some legal issues that came around that made U.S. soccer change its decision just to have one primary youth funnel to open it up to. Now there's about five of them. And, you know, and again, that's created a whole different sort of can of worms. But back in the 70s, it was that information draw that really kind of put the emphasis on what USYS was able to do.
Yeah, Kent, I think Skip's being a little self-deprecating in that one of the positives, and I can't tell you how Hans Sterley started AYSO. Part of it was, you know, they didn't want to be as competitive, that they wanted the kids to play half a game. But I think the beauty of what U.S. youth soccer has done for 50, 60 years now, is that they could appeal to a player regardless of his or her want to be, in the select system. And we get all caught up in all these different labels now, God bless, trying to keep track of them. But I think the difference is that Skip in U.S. youth soccer really tries to give the player the opportunity to go to the level they want to go to. If you just want to play on Saturday afternoons and have fun with your teammates, have at it. And it's the parents that get in the way most of the time.
In addition to being self-deprecating, I'll say what Skip probably wasn't willing to, which is 5 funnels, 6 funnels, 7 funnels is too many. It's caused problems that we need to reconcile, which I think is something we'll get into in a bit more detail. I do have some questions about the landscape moving forward, but you've both mentioned this idea of pathways and just getting kids out to play. We've seen a little bit of a decline in recent years. I think it's fair to say kids have distractions. They want to play video games. There's challenges just getting out and playing. How do you think about really bringing that joy for, whether it's chasing butterflies or standing in the middle of a field like I had with my daughter, getting that back into this next generation? Because I think that is a key role that you think USYS plays, Skip, right?
No, it does. And when I look at it, I mean, if you think about the global soccer landscape, you know, there's going to be more international games coming to the United States over the next 10 years than we've probably ever seen in one one, you know, time frame. You got the Men's World Cup, the Olympic Games, the Women's World Cup, you know, the Gold Cup. I mean, there's just a plethora of international events coming. And so from my perspective, it's not so much how do we create that legacy drive to get kids to play soccer, because I don't think, you know, we need to really worry about growing the game. Almost every kid that's 6 years old is going to kick a soccer ball at some point. The issue that I see, and really where my focus is and our focus is as an organization, how do we keep kids playing soccer? You know, and you hinted at, we've got 5, 6, 7 different funnels going into U.S. soccer. You know, you've got big business coming into youth sport just in general, that we're seeing a decline in participation earlier and earlier because kids are either burnt out, they don't feel like they're good enough, they're not having fun, they can't play with their friends, and we've created almost just one track that they can take. You've got to go this way or you're not going to make it. And in today's world where kids want to do what they want, when they want, where they want it, it's almost too much. And we, you know, and I profess this all the time, is that we need to create an officially sanctioned alternative program. And if you look at the landscape in youth sport, football had problems with concussions. Flag football is now going through the roof and on the girls' side doing extremely well. Basketball created 3v3. Hockey is going to street hockey. Lacrosse is going to sixes, a smaller, more condensed version. You know, we still always drive the 11v11. And as much as there are sort of the one-offs doing, you know, the 7v7s, the 5v5s, there's no official alternative program to keep all those kids involved in the game. And if we do that, then the numbers for us are going to soar.
And as long as we've made them, without costing Skip his job, as long as we've made them fans for life, that's enough for us, right? That they understand. I mean, that never happened when Skip and I was younger, that, oh yeah, I played in college and now he's the chief buyer for Coke or Pepsi or whatever. So you know, we've had that experience now that we didn't have in the 70s and then now in the 90s, and those folks, hey, look at the television ratings for things. I mean, not only just Messi, which is a replay of Pelé in 77, but we now have, I've said this to my English friends for years now, that still poo-poo us. Anybody that doesn't think that soccer or football, call it what you want, I don't care, guys. Anybody that doesn't think soccer is not part of the fabric of American life is not paying attention.
I totally fundamentally agree with that. And on so many levels, and that's what makes this particular topic kind of complicated. I want to stay here for a little while because I think a lot of the ideas around ascension through soccer ranks really did start in the 70s. The Olympic Development Program, ODP, you alluded to that as being that initial funnel. They became this elevated concept of success at a young age. And so there were positives, and then maybe, you know, part of what then became this fragmented landscape of hyper-competitive leagues has a little bit of a history there. But I want to go back to some of the positives, because I think the problems that we're articulating, they matter. There's some of the challenges, Skip, that you have. But let's look at the other side of that, which is it's given a lot of people great memories and opportunity, right? I have vivid memories of driving down to North Carolina. I saw a picture come up in my Google Photos yesterday of my daughter at an ODP tournament. I remember those car rides, right? Those are the things that we should hold on to. And it does give your kids an opportunity to compete, achieve, try to take a game that hopefully they love and do something with it. So how do we harness that stuff as we move forward?
And I'll jump in on the ODP side. Again, you know, fully agree. I went through ODP and I never would have had the career I did if I hadn't gone through that program. But again, there's so many different avenues today. It makes it really difficult. But one of the things that we've done is in the past few years, when you go through your state ODP program, you get nominated and you go into the regional and then you go to national camps. And the national camps were great. And I think a lot of the kids really enjoyed the experience. but I think it kind of fell flat in today's kind of ecosystem. And so last year we made a decision that instead of having a national camp, we're actually going to take the ODP players at the national level and put them in tournaments. So we put certain age groups in the Dallas Cup, you know, and then we put other age groups in the Mayor's Cup. And, you know, the Dallas Cup is a worldwide tournament that brings some really top teams. And we won a couple of the age groups for the ODP team. And so, again, that started to put the polish back to the whole ODP conversation. And, it, you know, it's sort of marrying the old with the new. And if we're able to do that, you know, at the end of the day, we don't want parents to fall into that trap of every kid gets a medal. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's absurd. Soccer is still a game where you win or you lose. And at some point, you need to understand that as a player, your character development is going to be enhanced when you win and also when you lose and how you're able to adapt to adversity. And so we need to kind of celebrate all that and let kids understand that it's okay if you just want to play for fun. You don't have to play for your high school or college or MLS or NWSL team. You have to play because it's what's driving you from your heart. And that's the messaging that I think we all need to start pushing. And that will enable the kids, you know, to say, look, I'm going to go out to the field on my own terms. Where I go is up to me, not my parents, not my coach. It's going to be up to, you know, what I want.
It's a societal thing. I mean, I went, everybody loves teams that go 27-0. I lost the last 33 consecutive basketball games I played in high school. It was a New York State record at the time. I went 15-68 in high school.
And you turned out
somebody
just
has
fine.
To do that, right? But Skip hits it entirely on the head. It's our parents are taking over for what that kid should like, what he should think about, or he or she. And one of the things I wanted to reference earlier when we were talking about it, look at the craziness about you can't play for your high school team if you play in a club.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And those kids, particularly on the women's side, that's their friendships. And to not let them do that for the 12 games of the season or whatever it is in high school, I just think that's short-sighted and too territorial and all that stuff.
You know, and to play on that, I mean, I played for a club team in Mercer County, New Jersey, and we didn't play local teams. We played the NASL reserve teams. We played European adult teams. You know, we had guys like Glenn Myernick, you know, Mooch, and most of the players on that club either played D1 or they went on to the NASL. And as much as that was such a great experience, I'm more proud of the two state championships I won when I was at high school than anything my club ever did, because you're playing in front of your school, you're playing in front of your parents, your community. It's the social, as Tom said, it is the social aspect that will create memories for a lifetime. And you want kids to have that, you know, because if most kids, when their clubs are playing, their parents show up, maybe a sibling, rarely a friend, but you're not really playing for anybody else but really yourself, which is great. But the high school is a whole different dynamic, and I hope we never lose sight of that.
You both mentioned this idea of open play. You haven't said it in those words, but just getting kids to go out and play. So this is almost a contradiction, but let's ask it anyway. How does an organization whose principles are about organizing play promote open play? Because I think in many respects, if we talk about this idea of parents taking over and giving the game back to the kids, Tom, you mentioned earlier, they should just want to go out and play because they love it. And Skip, you mentioned it should be about their love, their passion for the game. We've lost the ability in a society where we're litigious, there's restrictions, there's safety protocols. How do we do that?
You know, from that standpoint, I mean, I firmly believe rising tide benefits all boats, in the sense that if you get a million more kids that are staying involved with the sport or just coming to soccer because of the open play dynamic, a good number of them are going to actually go, you know what, I actually think I'm good and I want to go join the club team. And so, you know, if you look at so many of the kids today that play for their club, you know, again, my personal belief, and I was one that when I finished practice, I still carried a ball around. I practiced at home. I was always doing something with the ball. If the kids today whose parents think they're going to be a D1 scholarship player, if their affiliation with the soccer ball ends at practice and they don't do anything with it in the backyard, they don't do anything with it in the schoolyard, they've got no chance of getting anywhere. Right. And so from that standpoint, we need to find a way to promote the open play. How do we work with schools to be able to get schoolyards to be open? And they don't need to register with us, but there's got to be an app on the phone. And I know they do it in some other sports, although it's more for the adults, where you can just check in and say, hey, I want to go play 3v3, you know, or I want to go play tennis or go for a run. How can I do that? That technology is there. We just need to better define how we can do that and not be so committed to how it's always been, that if you're not registered with us, we don't want to talk to you. We can't have that paradigm anymore. We should have everybody that just wants to kick a ball want to be associated with us through play. And if they register with us, great, but play.
Yeah, the other part of it is, Kent, I think, and Skip, you would kind of agree, I think, that we also the parents tell them that they, and it goes back to my story about the field too narrow. The kids want a pristine environment. We didn't have that when we were kids. Yeah. I mean, the backboard had a board missing when I was a kid, but we went out every day and shot baskets or whatever. And I would go back, and Skip is much closer to it than me, but I would go back to the leadership, the authority, not that, but the positive authority of a coach. Hey, Joe, you want to get better? Then go out, go out and kick the ball. You're across the street from the elementary school. There's nothing going on there. There's a brick wall there. Go use the brick wall. You don't need to have six nets and five pieces of equipment to go get better with a ball coming off the brick wall. And that's something that I think coaches can encourage them on their own to be better.
You know, and as you go, two directions on what Tom was just saying. One is, I can only imagine what parents would say if their kids played when I played at the Met Oval, which had one strand of grass on the entire field. The rest of it was just dirt. But the funny thing was, I was at a regional championships for our national championships a couple of years ago, and it had been raining for days. And there was a game going on, and a parent came up to me, and it was a quagmire out there. And the parent was just reading me the riot act. How dare we let kids play in such an unmanicured field? And I looked at the parent and I said, are you watching the same game I'm watching? And they said, yes. And I said, it's the same for both teams. And did you see the kid who just slid tackle almost halfway across the field? He got up laughing his head off at a regional championship. Yeah. And again, those are the things. It's the same for everybody, but we have to get out of the mindset that unless they're playing on a definely manicured turf, it's not soccer. I mean, that's just absurd.
Yeah. For last one, Kent. I took the first trip I ever took for the, and I worked for U.S. Soccer back in the 90s, is I went to a regional tournament. I don't remember, but it was Lincoln, Nebraska, which isn't actually, you know, soccer central. And they went to a brand new complex. And this guy who had built this complex was so proud of himself. And he had U10 girls playing, and the field lines were permanent. He had these kids playing on a 120 by almost 77 yard wide field at U10. And you couldn't find it. You wouldn't find a boy, a young man or whatever, getting the ball into the 6 yard box from in that kind of a thing. But he was so proud of that and had no concept of horses for courses. Let's make it fit to their abilities. And that's just knowledge and learning a little more and talking about it. And he was just proud of his complex.
Is this where we talk about pay to play? Is it really about those pathways? Because, you know, we talk about the many funnels, right? We're not saying names. I'll say names, ECNL, for example. There's pressure if you show any success, someone recruits you to another team. With that team comes more dollars. Then there's this concept of eliminating huge parts of the population from participating in that. Pay to play is taken on the guy in Dallas, I think you said, Tom, who's driving his Mercedes, or the cost of getting extra training. How do we make the game more inclusive overall?
And from my perspective, you know, the pay to play model in youth sport is here to stay. It's never going to go away. The difference, and I use an analogy within education. You know, I mentioned I went to the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey. You know, that is pay to educate. I went to the University of Vermont, which is a state school. There are plenty of parents, and we're one. Two of our three kids went to Ivy League schools. We paid through the nose for them to have that ability. But for every kid that goes to a private institution, there is a pathway called state schools that allow kids that don't have the financial resources to do it. In youth sport, we're mostly about the pay-to-play model. We're mostly about the private education model. And so where we need to be able to expand is to create that state school mentality in sport. And the reason we struggle against, say, any other country in the world is that most countries, the government subsidizes sport. They have a ministry of sport. You know, and in the United States government doesn't fund the U.S. Olympic Committee. You know, our Olympians have to survive on whatever they can raise on their own. A huge difference. And so, again, from our perspective, if we're going to be able to make this work, and we're doing what we can, is creating that second pathway, you know, that public sport institution, and celebrate that so that it doesn't matter who you are or what your resources are, you still should have an ability and a canvas to be able to go show your skills at whatever cost. We just can't let the pay-to-play model be the only narrative that defines youth sport.
I'll admit, I hadn't really thought about it through that lens. I think the analogy to private school, state schools is really interesting and compelling, though there's even a national sort of political debate about how we handle all of that. So, Skip, I want to be respectful of both your time. So I want to ask one final question to you, and then I'll let you go, even though I think we could do this for another couple hours because the stories are pretty fantastic. I now understand a little bit better how the two of you are connected and have a good friendship. What's next? How do we move forward from here? I think your honesty and kind of your vulnerability about the state of U.S. youth soccer and just general youth sports is awesome. It's compelling. It's refreshing. But how do we move forward? I think a lot of ideas have been bandied about.
I mean, from our purview, unifying the landscape has to be the top priority, you know, because they're with so many different lanes, you're not creating a player development paradigm. You're creating a group of cannibals that want to steal from other teams. And they want to, you know, if my team's not doing well, I'm going to steal from your team because you play for one of the other organizing bodies. And it's all about how do we position ourselves in the best possible light. We can't have that anymore if we truly want to have the best country in the world from a soccer perspective. So having that unified pathway is absolutely critical, but also that secondary pipeline where kids can go just to play and have fun, that if, when they turn 13, 14, 15, they don't have to feel like there's nowhere for them to play if they're not playing elite travel soccer. We need to be able to give everybody the chance to play whatever their level is.
I want to ask you a follow-up on that. You must be having those conversations now. Are you optimistic that there is an appetite to unify those pathways?
There's an appetite. I think the hardest part is you've got two human characteristical hurdles. Change is an allergen, and nobody wants to vote themselves off the island. And so when you have some organizations that are nonprofit, some organizations that are for-profit, how do you bring them together under one umbrella to make it work? Someone's going to have to leave the island. And, you know, some people are going to have to change the dynamics. I mean, just within our state associations alone, as great as they are in doing what they're doing, some of them have governance structures that date back to the 1970s that are almost handcuffing. And they'll say it too, but nobody wants to change it. So, you know, it's the whole industry needs to look in the mirror. And as I say to our staff all the time, if we were building USYS for tomorrow's players today, what would it look like?
I'm going to thank you both. We'll close there. Skip Gilbert, CEO of USU Soccer. Tom Meredith, someone who has done many things in the world of soccer, leadership positions at the Women's United Soccer Association, U.S. Soccer Federation. He's worked World Cups, Copa Americas, incredible perspective. I am really grateful you both gave time to this Founding Football Project. Fun.
Absolutely, Kent. We could have gone for hours.
This is a weird comparison, but humor me. When Michael Jordan emerged as a top NBA player early in his career, he still couldn't break through as a playoff winner for a few years. Of course, basketball is a team sport, so it wasn't just Jordan. There were other players and coaches, and famously Doug Collins was the coach of Jordan's Bulls from 1986 to 1989. See, with Jordan, but without Collins, the Bulls were pretty bad, posting a record of 30-52. But then with Collins at the helm, the Bulls completely flipped that record by his second season as coach, going 50-32. And by his third year, the Bulls were in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's successful, right? Well, the Bulls lost to the Detroit Pistons in that playoff series, and the belief was that Collins could not get the Bulls to the next level, to their ultimate goal of being NBA champions. They were right, maybe. Phil Jackson took the helm in 1987, and the rest is history, because together with Jordan, the Bulls won six NBA titles with the two of them in Chicago starting in 1990. Of course, that's only part of the story. See, someone else arrived in 1987, and that man's name is Scottie Pippen. Often considered the best supporting actor in sports history, Pippen himself was also named one of the top 50 NBA players of all time during the 1996-97 season. Using a basketball metaphor in a soccer podcast is definitely a choice, but I think it's a good one. The world knows of Michael Jordan's greatness, but it wasn't immediate, and it also wasn't as simple as people think. Doug Collins did a good job as his coach, so why change? And while everyone thinks Phil Jackson was the answer, he and Jordan still needed Scottie Pippen. So too, you can ask, why did America need another youth soccer organization when AYSO and Say Soccer already existed? They were good organizations. They still are good organizations. But U.S. soccer needed more, and U.S. youth soccer was seeking to give the country that more that it needed. It gave the same infusion of structure that Phil Jackson gave to the Bulls with the triangle offense, and the same elevation of talent with ODP that Scottie Pippen gave the Bulls on the basketball floor. Immediately, there were two elements that made it the right organization at the right time. The first was a democratized structure that simultaneously let state associations remain autonomous and gave them the right infrastructure to come together and compete. In a world where the middle class and the urban sprawl were growing rapidly in the 70s, and the youth soccer revolution took to the suburbs, this made it easier to travel for competitive games than it would have been without. The second key was an association with U.S. soccer. It was clear that by being part of the infrastructure of the U.S. system, it gave the organization credibility, and a few years later, would even do more than that. Greer was the vice president of the USSF 2 years before he founded U.S. Youth Soccer. But then there's a third reason that's connected to the other two structural elements that made USYS really separate itself from the pack. That's the Olympic Development Program. As you heard Skip and Tom say, ODP made USYS a direct conduit and a direct pipeline for American soccer talent to the national team. Was that important in making soccer popular in America? Again, not directly. People weren't paying to watch ODP games, but they were paying for more kits, more travel, and more coaching. More participation was making soccer a bigger part of people's personal and collective cultures. If the goal then is to reach the national team through those structures, you're likely to watch those teams. Creating a rooting interest and the U.S. men's and U.S. women's national teams, creating lifelong bonds with a game that will translate into choices. Choices to watch soccer. Choices to watch a soccer game instead of a football game or a baseball game becomes more obvious. More people play because of U.S. youth soccer. More people connect their playing experience to the athletes at the top of the game because even if those pathways are not ones they can follow, they are aware of them. They are part of the organization that created them. They are connected to them. That is why U.S. youth soccer mattered when it was founded in 1974, and that's why it still matters today. And it's certainly why it has contributed to the popularity of soccer in America. Thank you for listening to Chapter 4 of Founding Football, the founding of U.S. youth soccer. I'm your host, Kent Malmrose. This episode features original music by Hayden Malmrose. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review Founding Football. For more information or show notes, visit our website at foundingfootball.com. We'll be back next week with Chapter 5, Pele Comes to New York. We'll see you then.